The presidential motorcade had just passed through heavy crowds in downtown Dallas and was circling through the fringes of the business district when three shots suddenly rang out.
Destroying the media lies and dismantling the narratives. One story at a time. It's the Adrian Slade Show.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Adrian Slade. I'm probably going to catch a lot of flack from both sides of the aisle on today's show, because we need to talk about a couple of things that are happening, a couple of things that are developing that are disturbing on both sides of the aisle. And first, we're going to look at the GOP. And now, Trump fans out there, you know me, if you've listened to me, and if you haven't, you know that I've praised Trump when he has done things that have fallen into conservatism. You know, I praised him when he appointed a conservative Supreme Court justice. I praised him when he gave us some tax relief. I've praised him when he recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I've praised him when he bashed the media because the media deserves it. They're not reporting as they should, objectively, inquisitively. They're just trying to build narratives and parrot their side. So, you know, I've given Trump praise when he deserves it, but I'm also critical of him because he was not my choice. And I, you know, we don't need to bring on a plastered Sam Nunberg hopped up on Prozac and Wild Turkey and Coke in order to criticize President Trump's policies. I mean, Trump himself has made some drunken type stumbles into conservative land, but you know, his war on free trade is this weird obsession he's had since day one of his campaign. He's brought that up from day one, right there along with the wall. So you have to go, what is his deal with trade? It's not that he's some economic genius, because past history shows that the trade wars were not always a good thing. I mean, it makes me think his conservative moves that he has made may have been for other reasons that conservatives inadvertently benefited from. I mean, you take the tax cuts. I mean, think about it when you think about the tax cuts in the grand scheme of things. So what did he do? He cut the corporate tax rate, which is the C corporation rate. He didn't cut the highest tax rates for individuals. And many people out there on the left are going to say, well, you know, they shouldn't let those rich fat cats receive tax breaks and, you know, whatever. The thing is, when you look at it from a business standpoint, again, the C corporation receives a tax at the entity or organization level. So the entity itself gets taxed on the profit it makes. But then the remaining profits that aren't reinvested into the business or not paid on cost and what have you, they get distributed to the shareholders, which they get taxed at that highest rate. But those aren't the only ones that are receiving the highest rate. The others are the S corporations. The S corporations don't get taxed at the organization level. They have to report their profits, and then it gets distributed to their owners, and the owners pay the tax. So if there are owners of S corporations that fall into the same bracket that some of the C corporation owners fall into, well, they don't get the tax cut. And there are four times as many S corporations or pass-through entities than there are C corporations. So what does that say? That says the tax cut at the corporate rate, while being beneficial to the economy, because it's going to help hire more employees. I mean, we're going to love some things about the corporate tax cut. It doesn't do anything for the majority of small businesses, S corporations, that may fall into those tax, you know, the owners of those S corporations might fall into those tax brackets. So was that a conservative move or was that a crony capitalism move? I mean, think about what happened with the regulations. We cheered. Oh, he reduced, you know, 22 regulations for every one. What regulations were those? I've still been trying to find them. I'm digging that up because I would like to see the correlation between the C corporations the tax cuts that they're receiving and whether or not the regulations that were cut directly benefit those industries. Could very well be. I would surmise that I'm probably right, but I don't have the proof to back that up quite yet. But that makes me think conservatives go, regulation cuts? Heck yeah, we've been wanting that. Cut away. Ginsu that crap. But if you're a crony corporatist, this might benefit you directly. Think about what happens with tariffs. Typically, the price of a product is basically the cost to create it, the cost to get it, you know, available, and the additional markup for a return on investment, the profit. This markup will be determined acceptable by what the customer is willing to pay and what the competition will help narrow that price down to into a certain range. Of course, that range is going to span the levels of quality. You know, maybe you don't care about the level of quality. Maybe you'll pay a little bit more because it's made from such better grade, items. Maybe there's customization that will add value that makes you want to pay a little bit more. But that range is where the price is going to be. It's going to be the price of where someone is willing to pay. So what happens when government steps in and places tariffs on imports of the similar products? Well, government has now manipulated the price. It distorted the price because it unnaturally changes what a business is willing to sell a product for. They now have to include that cost, the cost of that tariff, the effects of that tariff into the cost of their price, unnaturally changing the price. So the market price gets shifted. And then they're going to, you know, what's going to happen is the market price for things coming in, now being unnaturally shifted, allows the industry that resides in the country that isn't taxing them, isn't hitting them with tariffs, well, then they get to raise their price to match the new equilibrium, the new unnatural price. And a lot of people say, oh, that sounds great, right? MAGA, America first. That's narrow-minded thinking at best. If other nations don't participate, you know, if they have lower barrier entries, they have lower tariffs, they're not going to raise their tariffs to match ours, well, then they're going to shop with other nations that can provide that product for a lower price. And that protected business will be selling or will not be able to sell and compete with those other global businesses. You know, there's a difference between globalization of government and free trade that's interconnected across the globe. So that's going to reduce the level of customers that the home country industry is going to receive. That's going to cause downsizing. That's going to cause layoffs. That's going to cause reduced investment. That's going to cost, you know, it's going to have detrimental outcomes. So how does that help America? In fact, Harley-Davidson had issue with this. They put out a news story that says, Harley-Davidson says punitive retaliatory tariff is going to cause significant impact on its motorcycles. I mean, do we really want Harley-Davidson to be decimated? And the steel industry has been doing well based on innovation and automation. You know, they've actually, this from a tax, I think it's called Tax Authority. It's a magazine that I ran across, a little news article, but it said, the steel industry in particular has been transformed in recent decades. It shifted away from vertically integrated plants that smelted their own steel from scratch towards more efficient, highly automated mini mills, which primarily recycle existing steel and employ many fewer people. As older, less efficient mills closed, jobs disappeared, even if production didn't. There have been some effects from trade, but they're definitely in order of some magnitude smaller than what's going on with productivity growth, says Alan Collard Wexler, a Duke University economics professor. This suggests, he says, that even if companies themselves benefit from tariffs, they're just not that likely to need many more workers to ramp up the output. If they even ramp up output much at all, that is, the kind of steel produced by these mini mills is pretty different from what we import. Collard Wexler explains, and it's not clear if firms here have great substitutes for those abroad. Tariffs may just mean we see higher prices. Of course. You know, We have a president who is giving us a decent amount of capitalism, but delivering us cronyism that we free market capitalists despise. I mean, there's talk of exemptions, favored businesses chosen by government. That was my issue. Go back and listen to some of the shows that I did as soon as he was elected, or even coming up for election. Market share will be determined by the strong arm of government aiding the businesses who play ball and receive the favorable treatment. Think about Walmart. Why would Walmart support a $15 hour minimum wage hike? Because they understood government would force the cost of labor to increase. Now, they have the profit margin to weather the storm. Whether their competition can or not, they most likely wouldn't. And that right there will cost, that, you know, they will buckle. They will collapse under the weight of the increased cost of labor. So they shut down their competitors. The businesses can't cope with the new labor cost, and Walmart scoops up the available market share and expands its business with the helping hand of government. That's not capitalism. That's actually close to Chinese-style economics. The only difference is that in China, they require the government to own shares and become shareholders of organizations. So on the other side of the break, I want to read a blog that I did reflecting on President Trump and his obsession with the trade war and the trade tariffs and the trade deals on the other side of the break.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
So all this talk about the increase of tariffs on aluminum and steel and, you know, I'm not holding up Coke cans and talking about how it's not going to affect anything. And I'm not holding up soup cans and say, look, it's not going to be a big deal, because it is. It made me want to go back because it keeps bringing back that Herbert Hoover aspect of his campaign platform that bothered me. It's like, you know, I remember when National Review had a collection of conservatives basically coming out and saying, President Trump, you're not a conservative. And he got livid. His followers were livid, and they blasted anybody who stated that he wasn't a conservative. Really, what they were blasting is saying, oh, you don't think he's an authentic Republican, where the conservatives that were standing up and saying he wasn't a conservative were doing so because they actually believed in what conservatism meant. It wasn't just a new term thrown around to call yourself Republican. And it caused this gigantic rift to where Donald Trump was saying, oh, I am the most conservative president. But really, when you looked at his platform, he was more of a Teddy Roosevelt Bull Moose Party mixture of Herbert Hoover. And maybe he's got some economic, business savvy to allow conservative ideas to come in, because you cannot shun conservatism completely and own a business. I think it's impossible to do that, because you have to know what makes business run. Although there's plenty of businesses, Starbucks down the line, that feel that, you know, their political ideology has to stay in check, even though they employ aspects of capitalism, because they feel so strongly in their progressivism. But overall, if you boil down the nuts and bolts of capitalism, it would be something that a business owner would celebrate. So back in March 18th of 2016, my birthday, by the way, I actually wrote a blog post. It's not up on adrianslade.com. It was actually something I did for a website years ago that's now folded, called Politified. And I haven't actually posted this because at the time I felt, times have kind of moved on and the climate of the news cycle has changed. It's probably not worth checking out until all of this tariff stuff came up, to where I basically stated, we're witnessing the Armageddon of the two-party system through this election. Meltdown's on us. American politics is in disarray. Republicans are witnessing the fracturing of their party, eerily similar to that of the demise of the Whig Party in 1854. Although slavery was at the crux of the Whig Party's demise, a new type of strong-fisted subservience that has suppressed the Republican electorate is now leading to a subversive revolt by its own constituents. Now, for the Democrats, the superdelegate ruse is emerging without apology, which is indicative to their governing style. You'll take what we give you and you will like it. In fact, the political two-party system's demise has been unwittingly set course by the obtuse and out-of-touch mentality of their political ruling classes. That caused the rise of Trump. That caused the movement on the left towards progressivism and Bernie Sanders socialism. This is an exclusive club that we the people have assumed to have elected as public services to represent our interests, but in actuality, we've elected to relinquish our voice and have essentially positioned ourselves to be completely shut out of the process altogether. A desire for the citizenry for change is due based upon decades of being governed against our own representatives. It has led us long past due to an overhaul in order to reconstruct and change this behemoth of a ruling monstrosity. Those seeking change are seeking a different type of leadership. Out-of-the-box creative methods are now being embraced as an alternative to the typical political stylings of our current career representatives. What type of leader should we seek? Should we employ an outsider? Should our chief executive have executive experience with a history of leadership? Should we look towards a military leader? Or shall we seek a successful private sector leader to steer the American steamliner? In the age of political discourse and disaffection of the political system, many believe a successful person who was accomplished in business would be the most effective hire for this position. Although successful private sector experience is appealing on paper, with the real-world application, this may not yield the most successful results. Being a business owner may give you experience in the executive realm to a degree, but contrary to your opinion, it does not qualify you to be the chief governing executive of America. Yeah, as a business owner, you lead those with whom you've hired. The difference is, as president, we're not your employees. You work for us. As a business owner, you're beholden to your board of directors. A board of directors is not the equivalent of Congress. The board of directors represents the business interest. Conversely, Congress represents the interest of its people. It's a completely different mindset altogether. As a business owner, you make deals with other business interests in order to edify and satisfy the company's interest with efficient ease. In government, gridlock is instituted by design in order to ensure that what makes it through its fire is a tortured result for the best interest of its citizenry. In business, the company does not necessarily work for its employees. The employees work to further the goals of the business that employs them. The decisions that the business makes is not always in line with the employees' desires. They're mostly enacted for the betterment of the business itself, to which the employees receive residual benefits. In government, the representatives are elected to seek the interest of their citizens, the nation receiving the residual benefits of those decisions. With business, you follow the business culture, code of ethics, company policies and procedures. If those policies and procedures and rules need adjusting, well, you just adjust them for the betterment of the business. That isn't necessarily the case with the Constitution of the United States. You have to go through the amendment process to switch anything. The lengths to one must go in order to change the Constitution are tremendously difficult to obtain. It should also be noted that the president cannot elect to make these changes themselves in order to fit the wishes of their desired results. Although the government may have similar characteristics as that of a business, they are diametrically opposed to one another in how they operate. History has provided insight into the results of electing a businessman to the highest level of leadership in the land of the free. The last time we placed faith of our nation in the hands of a businessman was the election of Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover was a successful businessman in the mining industry. Once he conquered the private sector, he yearned to conquer politics, although he gave the outward impression that he was being reluctantly pulled into the executive cabinet positions. He was affiliated with Woodrow Wilson's ultra-progressive Democrat administration. He switched his party affiliation back to the Republican Party, which was the party he was registered to before World War I. Now, he did show support for a period of time to the Bull Moose Progressive Party of Theodore Roosevelt. Hoover's populist nationalism was something that he mined during the end of the Roaring Twenties, leading to the beginning of the 30s, just before the ensuing economic collapse. Increased wealth taxes on the highest brackets and higher corporate tax rates imposed by Herbert Hoover aided in stunting the economic growth of the private sector, while at the same time balancing the federal budget. Trade tariffs were passed, such as the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930, as a way of providing the private sector a form of protectionism. In the burgeoning age of the new economy, The Tariff Act of 1930 was actually counterproductive and further exacerbated the economic collapse, minimizing the attempts of the recovery of the Great Depression. The Great Depression ensued deeper, which led to unprecedented unemployment. The various Hooverisms littered the agents, the legacy of this big business president. Hoovervilles, which were filled with unemployed residing in dilapidated shacks, began to spring forth throughout the nation. Ultimately, having incredible success in the private sector was proven not to be a litmus test for an effective executive, elected executor. History is set up to repeat itself again with the economic malaise into its 8th year. Well, now it's kind of slightly moving out, but we may stun it. We face similar paths of economic recovery and governance. With a political class that has rejected and ignored its very own electorate for the financial gains and influence of lobbyists and big business, Americans are fed up with crony corporatism. Career politicians, relationships on both sides of the aisles are in question. And the question you'll have to ask and examine within yourself is, why would I allow a businessman to cut corners, change positions on numerous occasions, and grease the government wheels to benefit their personal life? At the same time, why would I demand with unwavering fervor a politician have consistency with absolutely no tolerance towards a movement in their policy positions? So that's Clinton and Trump. We should also ask, in the course of a national crisis, would the Constitution be the guiding light to which the leader that we hire would look towards for guidance? Or will an authoritative administered solution with the simple basis of just getting results be what's regarded without any regard for constitutional principles? These are the questions we should be asking of our selection of our executive leader of the free world. Simply having business experience may not be necessary for the cure of our disaffection in the current political system. That's what I basically came up with back during the primary process. And it looks as though we are starting to head into that area with these tariffs. Now, on the other side of the break, we need to get into what's happening with the co-opting of narratives and the funding by all of these different groups on the left who are all culminating together, making strange bedfellows with each other in order to attack and minimize the Constitution and our representative republicanism. Back in a moment.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
Welcome back. Well, Donald Trump's economic advisor, Gary Cohen, beelined to the door, former Goldman Sachs, over Donald Trump's bull moose party, Herbert Hoover-style protectionist tariffs, the left was doing something else. No, they weren't eating crappy barbecue plates from New York that looked like Michelle Obama's school lunch program. They were actually doing a couple of things. They were wearing halo brows that looked like somebody took a coat hanger, put it upside down, and branded their forehead like a calf. Or they were going to great events like the one being held in the Coliseum in Chicago. The Savior's Day.
Sunday, February 25th at the Wintrust Arena. It's the crowning event of Black History Month. It's Savior's Day. With the keynote address by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan.
We want to make our own community live, and we can't do that until we take control of our community.
The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. That's 2 p.m. Sunday, February 25th at the new Wintrust Arena. Doors open at noon. Tickets are available at Ticketmaster.com.
Sounds great. All this talk of lifting up the community. I mean, we get a minister talking about some great things about helping the community. Let's hear a little bit more about how he plans to bring the community together and lift it up.
There's not a white man on the earth that has the strength of Louis Farrakhan. I'm a young God.
Hey, minister, I'm pretty sure that God actually said, thou shalt not have any other gods before me. But anyways, go on with your little tirade.
The government is my enemy. The powerful Jews are my enemy. and scared to death Negroes are my enemy. And weak Muslims and hypocrites are my enemy. But here I stand.
Wow, Minister Farrakhan's got a full plate of enemies there. He doesn't like the government, which, you know, I have my qualms with, but I don't call them an enemy. I seem to think they just need to be like that little redheaded stepchild you just hold your hand on and let them swing in the air, just keeping them at distance, keeping them at bay. The Jews are his enemy? I mean, it's amazing to me because he always talks about how he's, you know, unabashed with the things that he despises. And check out his views on women. Pretty insightful.
Your children, driving you out of your mind, take me to Mickey D's. See, you lazy woman. You don't want to get in a damn kitchen and cook, so you bring your children to these fast food places, killing them and yourself because you're too damn lazy and trifling to cook again. Who the hell wants a woman with a good shape and a fat behind that don't know how to prepare no food for her husband and her children? To hell with a woman like that. Your grandmother knew how to cook. You know how to make a baby, but don't know how to cook food. You know how to shake your behind, but don't know how to rattle some eggs in a pan.
Wow, he's gonna tell the women to go rattle some eggs. You know your place, women. What's even more crazy about that is that the Women's March leaders were in attendance. I'm serious. Sounds like he's for the elimination of sexism and racism, huh? Doesn't it? But Jake Tapper actually had issue with the fact that some of these people were there. News broke that Women's March leader Tamika Malloy was in attendance. She even received a shout-out from Farrakhan during his address and posted about the event on social media. Women's March leader Linda Sarsar, which we've talked about plenty on this show, has collaborated with the Nation of Islam in the past. Carmen Perez defended Farrakhan in the past, telling Amelia Harnish back in January that there are, quote, no perfect leaders and that people need to understand Farrakhan's contributions to black and brown circles. Understandably, the Jewish community, and this is from Refinery 6, particularly people who have supported the Women's March and other social justice causes, wanted answers. We also wanted something that most thought would be pretty simple for a bunch of women who spend their days parading around their intersectionality. We wanted them to denounce anti-Semitism and the words of Farrakhan against Jews. This isn't a new thing. After all, we ask our public figures to denounce awful people and hate speech all the time. Right, Donald Trump and the alt-right, Charlottesville, David Duke? That's to say, we didn't get that, you know, answer. Instead, we got Tamika Malloy posting bizarre series of tweets calling for valid criticisms, bullying, and refusing to apologize for her support for Farrakhan and her lack of denouncement regarding his own words. Haaretz elaborated on this, Haaretz magazine. Mallory eagerly promoted her attendance. Then, faced with widespread criticism from the Jewish community, she dug in her heels. Far from exhibiting any contrition or even curiosity as to why Jews might find being blamed for, among other things, quote, all of the filth and degenerate behavior that Hollywood is putting out repulsive, or that Jews might be offended that he declared that he would pull the cover off the eyes of the satanic Jew, I'm here to say your time is up, your world is through. Mallory instead unleashed a corker of a response to her Jewish critics, quote, if your leader does not have the same enemies as Jesus, they may not be the leader. Amazing. That didn't stop Mallory from some textbook gaslighting, saying, quote, funny how folks interpreted my mention of having enemies the same as Jesus as me describing a certain group of people. That's your own stuff. Well, actually, what she actually tweeted was, quote, if your leader does not have the same enemies as Jesus, they may not be the leader. Study the Bible and you will find the similarities. Ostracizing, ridicule, and rejection is a painful part of the process, but faith is the substance of things. Sounds like it was interpreted pretty accurately there, if you ask me. Now, Linda Sarsal, she decided, you know, she was cool with the silence and just retweeted one of Mallory's tweets, as did Bob Bland. Sarsal went on to say all these, you know, praiseworthy things about Mallory on a Facebook post. Carmen Perez took it one step further, quote tweeting Mallory and said something about the national organizer's, quote, lifetime commitment to liberation. Missing from that was condemnation of Farrakhan. Semitic Speech, the Anti-Defamation League, reported that anti-Semitic acts in the United States spiked 57% in 2017 over the previous year. CNN's Jake Tapper pressed the Women's March people on this issue and surprisingly held their feet to the fire over their lack of condemnation over Farrakhan's comments.
I want to turn to some news on Louis Farrakhan, the leader of the Nation of Islam. He went on an anti-Semitic rant during a major speech a week ago yesterday. Here's a little bit of it.
He talked about their grip in Hollywood and how the Jews were responsible for all of this filth and degenerate behavior that Hollywood is putting out, turning men into women and women into men.
Now, despite the anti-Semitism and homophobia inherent in that clip, several leaders of the Women's March are supporters of Farrakhan and have not condemned him. Members of the Congressional Black Caucus who have met with him were asked for their comments, and one of them, Congressman Danny Davis, not only refused to denounce Farrakhan, he said the world is bigger than him and his Jewish question. Why is it so tough for some people to condemn a rabid anti-Semite who is also a misogynist and anti-LGBTQ?
It should not be. But the reason this is relevant to our political world is, as you just noted, that there's disagreements, that people are going to be asked if they're going to denounce it for good reason. And there will be alignments that have been together, women, the CBC, others, that will have division over this. Why can't people criticize it? I mean, past relationships, their own caucuses and constituencies sometimes play, but it's still hard to understand.
It's a pretty low bar to denounce something like that. And the people who are, you know, supporting the Women's March, what are they out there supporting for? Equality and all this stuff. And that is the opposite of equality. So how is that that hard to denounce? And
It shouldn't be.
I love that they said Farrakhan's Jewish question. I'm pretty sure that involves Farrakhan's final solution, if you know what I'm saying. So obviously the Women's March organizers are total frauds. Let's remember what Linda Sarsar said about jihad in the current administration.
That we, when we stand up to those who oppress our communities, that Allah accepts from us that as a form of jihad, that we are struggling against tyrants and rulers, not only abroad in the Middle East or in the other side of the world, but here in these United States of America, where you have fascists and white supremacists and Islamophobes reigning in the White House. Our number one and top priority is to protect and defend our communities. It is not to assimilate and to please any other people in authority. Our obligation is to our young people, is to our women, and make sure our women are protected in our community. And our top priority, even higher than all those priorities, is to please Allah.
Yeah, no assimilation. Waging jihad, they want to say it's just struggle, but we talked about that on a show before. But she was also waging jihad when she was arrested, along with Kairs Nahad Awad and Imam Suleiman, over Capitol Hill for her support for DACA. That's right, DACA. And we'll get into more of this on the other side of the break. Stick with me.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
Welcome back. We were talking about how the Women's March organizers have been hanging out with Farrakhan. Farrakhan saying that women should get back in the kitchen and that he hates Jews, they're his enemy, and, you know, he hates the government and fake Muslims and fake black people. And Jake Tapper pressed them and they said, oh, it's no biggie. You know, he's got his Jewish question, which is actually his final solution. And Linda Sarsar, Kairs Nahad Awad, Imam Suleiman, and many others were arrested on Capitol Hill over their support for DACA. So they're pretty all over the place, marching for women's rights, marching for DACA, apparently Muslim leaders, this is from an article that I read the other day, who had once said that they had opened their mosque to people of all faiths, escaping ICE would be allowed. Now it seems they changed their mind. Imam Suleiman, who skillfully deflected and snowed an NPR reporter over his stance, he shifted the blame to Trump and merrily went after the band of haters when they suspected a change of heart may have come to hand, realizing that having a bunch of infidels living in their mosque could be problematic, and so he changed his position on whether or not they would accept immigrants or migrants into their mosque in lieu of being chased by ICE. But when we looked more deeply into the demonstration story, we saw that one of nine federally funded refugee settlement contractors, Church World Service, was an organizer of the media stunt that was happening with this Capitol Hill arrest. From Al Jazeera, Muslim American leaders have been arrested at the U.S. Capitol while urging Congress to stand against President Trump's efforts to end a program that protects certain young immigrants. Omar Sulmium, Dawad Walid, Mahajid Fletcher, Tablib Sharif, Nihad Awad of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Zahar Billo, and Linda Sarsal advocated immigration reform before getting arrested. The protesters participated in an act of civil disobedience at the office of Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Now, Church World Service was an instigator in this demonstration. According to a recent audit, they received 71% of their income from U.S. taxpayers. That amounted to about $62 million for 1 year. Incidentally, Church World Service subcontractor was responsible for placing refugees in Western Maryland. So now, why would we bring all this up? Why do we care about the Women's March? Why do we care about Farrakhan? Why do we care about the hypocrisy of the left that we know that they're capable of engaging in? Well, that's because the Women's March organizers are the ones, along with supporting Farrakhan's hatred of the Jewish community, along with supporting the fact that he says making men into women and women into men was an issue, even though that's the issue they stand for, apparently, they're also the ones supporting the March for Our Lives over the Second Amendment with the protesting kids of the Parkland School. That's right. Those grifting exploiters come up with groups of others to help push these kids, and it should raise eyebrows. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a Florida representative and former DNC chairwoman, was given a push. From BuzzFeed, barely 2 weeks ago, the student survivors sat in a circle in the living room around one of their parents' homes, planning a trip to Tallahassee to meet with lawmakers and handling nitty-gritty matters like which media outlets to talk to. Well, since then, major players and organizations, including Everytown, that's, you know, Shannon Watts and Michael Bloomberg, Giffords, which is Gabby Giffords, who was shot and survived the assassination attempt by a crazed gunman who was not a Tea Party member, Move On, which you know about MoveOn.org, and Women's March LA, who we just talked about and showed the hypocrisy of their own movement, told BuzzFeed News they're helping with logistics, strategy, planning for next month's March for Our Lives. Actually, it's coming up in just a week. The rally and beyond. So there's going to be more of this. Move On said it would encourage its millions of members to follow and promote March for Our Lives. A spokesperson for Planned Parenthood, which has not directly been in touch with the students, said it had been in contact and offered support to Giffords, which is spearheading the national coalition of groups working for March for Our Lives. So there's a lot of people behind the scenes that are making this push. The Democrat Party is fundraising off the backs of this horrific event, putting out an email mailer saying, this week, the Democrat Party launched I Will Vote, a national campaign to organize voters and to get them to the polls. Voting is the first step to ending gun violence, and they give you a link to where you can pay. Now, while Wasserman Schultz was lending a helping hand to March for Our Lives, she was also shielding her Pakistani IT tech frauds, the Awan brothers, who had access to DNC correspondence and information with no IT experience, and also be an enterprising auto salesman. They borrowed cars that weren't on their lot to give the appearance of auto inventory. And they also had an investor from Iraq who's a politician who had ties to Hezbollah. So there you go. But while she stepped down as being the head of the DNC, the current co-head of the DNC under Tom Perez is Keith Ellison, and he has interesting connections too. Not only is he a member of the Muslim Brotherhood and CARE, And he was on stage with Linda Sarzaro while she praised the co-conspirator of the World Trade Center 1993 bombing. He also was a dinner guest for Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and Farrakhan. Look at that. They all meet up, don't they? From Harrods, the deputy chair of the Democrat National Committee, Keith Ellison of Minnesota, was among the three congressmen, Democrat-related, who attended a private dinner in 2013 with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam leader has been a long accused individual of anti-Semitism and whom Ellison had previously denounced was in attendance as well. Now, Ellison is the first elected to Congress to be a Muslim and did not hold his DNC position at that time, but was a sitting New York member of Congress. And were also Democrat representatives Andre Carson of Indiana and Gregory Meeks of New York, who were also in attendance, which is funny about Carson. Going back to the Awan brothers from Pakistan, Carson was actually employing them as well. Anyways, we can remember the fact that Rouhani came to the United States for a UN meeting, and Rouhani was newly elected in 2013. He held this dinner in New York, and he attempted to moderate his stance towards Western audiences. You know, of course, the Iran government was the ones that still support groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. And this dinner was to coincide with his speech to the United Nations. So, I mean, we've seen pictures of Farrakhan and Colin Powell. We know these movements are not organic. They're all centered around CARE, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Congressional Black Caucus, from Black Lives Matter to Antifa to the Women's March to Me Too. It's all fake. It's all gaslighting. It's all a ruse to attack America, and I can't stand for that. We'll see you guys next week.